You know, the United States Constitution is not something that just happens out there somewhere. Cases don't all arise in Washington, D.C. or New York City or some other big important place. Constitutional cases arise wherever the Constitution applies, and that's all over the United States. So once in a while, we actually have a constitutional case right here in our own little hometown, our own little area of Northeast Tennessee and Southwest Virginia. And that happened recently when an Abington, Virginia lawyer named Dennis Jones caught a constitutional case and recruited some of my law students to help him with it. It's your weekly constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and this week it's all about a visit to the United States Supreme Court.
Welcome to your weekly constitutional, hosted by Professor Stuart Harris and produced in partnership with the Robert H. Smith Center for the Constitution at James Madison's historic home, Montpelier.
Dennis Jones is an attorney in Abingdon, Virginia, and I only recently had the pleasure of meeting Dennis, and I met him under somewhat unusual circumstances. You see, I was teaching my standard introductory course in constitutional law when some of my students came up and started asking very specific questions about a very specific issue involving criminal law, federal criminal law, and something called the commerce power. I'll leave the details out for the moment, but after a while, I started asking my students questions. Why are you interested in this particular subject or this particular aspect of the subject? And they said, well, we've found out that there is a local attorney who has a constitutional case that has just been docketed for oral argument at the U.S. Supreme Court. And I said, really? And they said, yes, and we're helping Mr. Jones, Dennis Jones, to prepare his arguments. Well, I knew at that very instant two things. First of all, I was very proud of my students for being able to lend support to an attorney on his way to the Supreme Court. And secondly, I was going to impose upon at least Mr. Jones to appear on the show and tell me the whole story.
My name is Dennis E. Jones. I'm a criminal defense attorney practicing primarily in federal court, do more complicated cases in state court, but do considerable amount of white collar work in the federal system, as well as other cases that come my way.
Mm-hmm. Anything that comes through the door, right? That's what I used to say when I was in practice.
Pretty much so in the federal system, because when you're in the federal system, you're always working with a more complex, complicated type of criminal matter. I don't do speeding tickets and that kind of stuff.
Mm-hmm. Well, I used to. I don't know that I ever did a speeding
ticket. Well, I did it one time.
Yeah. So you got this referral, and it's a case out of Roanoke, right?
Right.
So let's start from the beginning. Anthony Taylor, what was he accused of? What was he convicted of?
Anthony was accused of a Hobbs Act violation, and that's Title 18 United States Code 1351. And the Hobbs Act has two overt acts. One, of course, is extortion, and the other is robbery.
Isn't that interesting? Let's just pause there. The Hobbs Act, which, and you cited a federal statute, that's why we're in federal court. Robbery and extortion? Those sound to me like local crimes.
Well, they are, but in order for them to be elevated, they're generally common law crimes.
Right.
But the Congress decided that if there was a robbery or an extortion that occurred, the extortion is under color of office, official office, which is a component of it, and then the robbery. But each one of those overt acts that occurs must have the word is effect on commerce.
I see. Okay. So and that reminds me. Okay. So let's just do a little primer on this. The commerce power, the ability to regulate interstate commerce, commerce between the states, is one of the most important powers set out in Article 1, Section 8 of the Constitution. And there are lots and lots and lots of federal statutes that are based upon that power, many of which you have to actually think about how they're related to commerce. In fact, a number of civil rights statutes are based on the commerce power. And what you're telling me now is that this Hobbs Act, this criminal statute with robbery and extortion as its targets, the crimes that it's defining, is also based ultimately on this commerce power. And I just have a sneaking suspicion we're going to come back to that later.
Yeah, it's an important part.
Okay, now.
The word effects, A-F-F-E-C-T, is in that statute.
So these crimes have to affect interstate commerce.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, let's leave that aside for the moment. But it comes to what exactly were the allegations that Taylor?
Mr. Taylor.
What had he done?
He was accused of he and three Confederates of targeting marijuana dealers. as their victims of the robbery and affecting home invasions of people who allegedly were dealing in marijuana. And as a consequence of that, they would rob those people. Drug dealers, when you use the word drug dealers generic, are good targets for people who to commit robberies, because if they are indeed a drug dealer, one does not typically expect that that robbery be reported to authorities, because they don't want the authorities investigating.
Calling 911, someone just stole all my illegal drugs.
Yeah. So, right. Not a smart move.
Not a smart move. That wouldn't happen. But I hadn't thought about that aspect of it. But the part that's obvious to me and probably to everybody listening is that a drug dealer is going to have drugs or cash or both.
And what's the significance of marijuana here?
Yeah. So absolutely. Okay. So I guess they would admit it with the caveat that a drug dealer might also have weapons.
So he was tried the first time, and there was a mistrial.
And this is all happening over in Roanoke. And
then this is happening in Roanoke.
Federal District Court.
It's tried before Judge Conrad, Chief Judge Conrad. And then the second trial, which occurred a few weeks, a couple of months after the first one, the government had filed a motion in limine to prevent the defense from putting on evidence that marijuana was an intra versus an interstate drug, and as a result of that, could not have an effect, not effect, but affect on commerce.
Okay. We have to pause there. You said several highfalutin legal terms.
Right.
A motion in limine, and everybody on television has seen lawyers jump up and say, I object. And then, you know, they get evidence either admitted or excluded during a trial, and that certainly happens.
Yes.
But it's better and more efficient if lawyers from one side or the other, knowing in advance what evidence their opponents are going to put on, file a motion with a judge before a trial so they can sort out beforehand whether certain evidence is going to be admitted or not admitted in a particular case. So the government filed one of those limiting motions beforehand, and they said they didn't want evidence of what put on by the defense?
That marijuana was an intrastate drug versus an interstate drug.
Okay, so you were, okay, again, we're coming back to the Constitution now.
Right.
You wanted to point out that the marijuana that was at these houses was likely something that was grown, processed, sold, all right here in the Commonwealth. In fact, a little geography lesson, Roanoke's kind of toward the middle of the state. It's on the western half of it, but it's not near any state border. And so that's pretty plausible that marijuana, and we're in a temperate area, you can grow marijuana here. Not that I have any experience with it, but I understand that people can grow marijuana here. So that was going to be your theory of the case, is that this federal prosecution was inappropriate because the marijuana in question did not affect AFFECT interstate commerce. And that's a good theory, but they wanted no such evidence introduced. Now, why do they think that was appropriate?
The rules of, as you mentioned earlier, the federal rules are a little more trial lawyer friendly, because you do a number of motions. Actually, the court will enter an order requiring you to file motions and have pretrial conferences prior to the trial. So that's part of the process. And the government's theory or proposition in their motion in limine was that the Fourth Circuit, a few years ago, in the case of United States versus Williams, had ruled that the robbery in another Hobbs Act prosecution, had ruled that the robbery of a drug dealer, again using the generic phrase, was by its very nature a per se effect on commerce.
Interstate commerce.
Yeah.
Because drugs move freely across state lines, right, and they're a multi-billion-dollar market.
Correct. And the distinction between the evidence in the Williams case and the evidence in the Taylor case was that the Williams case was a cocaine case.
Mm-hmm. And that's got to come from somewhere else.
In that case, there was a stipulation of evidence. And that, what a stipulation of evidence is where the government and the defendant, they agree to a fact as a proven fact. And they agreed and stipulated that in the Williams case that the cocaine had indeed traveled in interstate commerce, therefore affecting commerce.
Well, then that makes sense. If the defense is already stipulating that the cocaine moves in interstate commerce, then trying to produce evidence at trial that it's a purely local crime, is inappropriate. You can say, okay, so I'm following you. That's the Fourth Circuit case.
Right. But the target here and the evidence in the Taylor case was marijuana and no other drug.
Right.
So what Judge Conrad did, he accepted the proposition of the government and used the generic drug dealer ruling that a marijuana dealer was a subcategory of drug dealers and therefore was controlled by the Williams case.
So you were no longer able to use probably your most effective evidence.
It was gone. The case was over.
It was just gone because the motion in limine was granted and you couldn't bring in the evidence that the marijuana was all locally grown and it was therefore a local crime.
Right.
Which would have knocked it out of federal. In fact, it would have knocked out the federal prosecution.
So part of the evidence that would have been presented was a few months beforehand, before this case went to trial.
And what was the year of this case?
The first trial was in October of 2012, mm-hmm. and the second trial, in which Mr. Taylor was convicted, was in January of 2013.
Okay, please go on.
So a few months in the summer of 2012 in Beaudetort County, which is a county adjacent to or very near Roanoke County, there was a marijuana grow that was seized by the Beaudetort Sheriff's Department that was in excess of 3,000 plants. So that would have been a significant piece of evidence establishing that marijuana was indeed grown in the Commonwealth of Virginia. Whether it traveled across state lines or not was another factual determination that the government would have had to have proven.
Right. That's very interesting. All you had to do essentially was to point out and perhaps produce some evidence that marijuana is locally available. And of course, the government has the burden of proving beyond a reasonable doubt each and every element of the crime. And so they had the burden of proving an effect on interstate commerce.
Correct.
Okay. Well, that was a good strategy on your part. I'm sorry.
Didn't work.
It worked the first time, right?
Right.
Okay.
And what added to the significance of this case was, you know, the federal jurisdiction is the various federal courts are made up of circuits. And sometimes these circuits don't always agree.
Mm-hmm.
So in the Williams case was decided sometime, I think it was in 2007, 2008. In 2010 or 11. The Second Circuit, in a case out of New York, in case United States versus Needham, had reversed convictions of Mr. Needham for Hobbs Act convictions, and his target was marijuana.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason that the Second Circuit reversed that conviction was that the government had not put in any evidence on that demonstrated factually an effect on commerce. And in addition to that, in 2001, you had the case of United States versus Peterson, which came out of the Fifth Circuit.
Mm-hmm. And down in the South, the Deep South.
And that too was a Hobbs Act conviction that was reversed, and the target being marijuana. And no evidence was put on that the marijuana that was the subject of those robberies or its proceeds affected commerce.
It's your Weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and today we're talking about a visit to the Supreme Court. That is, a visit on official business because Abingdon, Virginia attorney Dennis Jones caught a case that he took all the way to oral argument. But before we go on, I want to note an omission. And the omission is that I don't have interviews to share with you from the three students who brought Mr. Jones and me together, but I do want to mention their names. Their names are Megan Barger and Aaron Gillespie and Brett Hall, all of whom helped Mr. Jones, all of whom brought us together, and all of whom should have participated in this, except for those silly final examinations. After the break, we'll have our constitutional quiz, and then we'll continue discussing a visit to the United States Supreme Court. Right now, it's time for another quiz. Is there someone on the line?
There sure is.
Well, who are you, sir?
My name is Jason Adams. I am from St. Paul, Virginia.
Do you listen to us in WEHC or in WETS?
WETS.
WETS, our home station. Well, that's marvelous. Okay, well, what do you got there, Doug?
All right, well, I've got a question, and I'm going to give you four choices.
Okay.
Are you ready?
I'm ready, but Jason, are you ready?
I'm certainly ready.
Okay.
Here we go, Jason. What capital city is asking its nearly 9 million residents to crowdsource a new constitution through social media? What capital city is asking its nearly 9 million residents to crowdsource a new constitution through social media? Is it A, Bern, Switzerland? B, Mexico City, Mexico? C, Kiev, Ukraine? Or D, Vaduz, Liechtenstein?
Vaduz?
Vaduz.
I didn't even, never even heard of Vaduz.
You probably hadn't heard of Liechtenstein.
No, I've heard of Liechtenstein.
It has a capital. It's Vaduz.
Okay.
I've driven through Vaduz. it takes about 10 minutes. let's see. 9 million people. Let's see. I doubt it's Mexico City because they've got a lot more than 9 million, depending on how you count the borders of the city. Let's see.
What about Switzerland?
I like Switzerland.
Mm-hmm.
And Switzerland's very smart with money.
Right. But are they crowdsourcing a constitution? And is Bern their capital?
There are bears in Bern, for what it's worth.
That's what I've heard.
Well, it's where the name comes from.
C was Kiev, Ukraine.
Mm-hmm. And?
And D was Vaduz.
Vaduz, that's right.
Yeah.
Okay.
Liechtenstein.
Those are your choices, Jason.
That's a great one. I think I'm actually going to go with Bern.
With Bern and Switzerland, 9 million people are going to crowdsource a new constitution. You think they need a new constitution in Switzerland?
Not really, but people like to refresh things.
Well, I suppose that's true. Is that your final answer, Jason?
That is my final answer.
Doug?
Sadly, it is not Bern, Switzerland.
Oh, I'm sorry.
That's true. It's Mexico City, Mexico.
No way.
Oddly enough, yes.
Okay.
I was with Jason on that. I thought Mexico City was much bigger population-wise than 9 million.
No, no. Mexico City is the latest municipality or government structure to try to crowdsource the Constitution. You'll remember Iceland tried this a couple of years ago.
Yes, I do.
They actually couldn't make a go of it with their 350,000 residents. And so the 9 million people of Mexico City are certainly to cause a little bit of a headache.
My.
Not to worry. There's kind of a big catch. The Constitutional Assembly will take whatever gets crowdsourced as a recommendation, but doesn't actually have to follow it.
Understood. All right.
Yep.
Check on pure democracy.
Well,
Jason, I'm very sorry that you didn't win today, but you still get a pocket constitution from James Madison's Montpelier. So send us an email at ywc@montpelier.org. And give us your address, and we will send that constitution to you.
All right, sounds good.
Thanks for playing.
Well, thank you all very much. Y'all have a good day.
And thank you, Doug.
Hey, you bet. You know, I'm all for crowdsourcing constitutions on Facebook. We should think about that in the U.S.
Next week, we'll do that.
Next week.
Got it.
It's the Constitution. I read it for the articles.
You're listening to Your Weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and I'm speaking with Abington, Virginia lawyer Dennis Jones about a recent visit he made on a case to make an argument in front of the United States Supreme Court. Now, as Dennis has pointed out, lots and lots of people want to argue in front of the Supreme Court. There are lots of petitions to argue in front of the Supreme Court. Only a relatively small number of them are granted in any particular year. And one thing that makes the court more likely to take your case is if different circuit courts of appeal have come to different conclusions on the same issue that your case now presents to the court. And it turns out that's exactly what Dennis Jones encountered.
Okay, so you had what's called the circuit split.
Correct.
The Fourth Circuit governs here in Virginia, so that was the one, that was the Williams case, and that's the one that you had to pay most attention to.
Right.
But when you looked at the Second Circuit over in New York or the Fifth Circuit down south, those had somewhat different cases, and so you felt that you could go a little further. So, and in fact, that's one of, well, I'm going to let you tell.
Well, the split in the circuits, I think, is the reason the Supreme Court took the case. And,
right.
And it's very common when you have a split in the circuits. And what we mean by split in the circuits is you'll have one circuit on ruling and deciding a particular way under a statute. And then you have a second circuit for that will interpret the application of that statute in a different way. So it creates a difference or a split in the interpretation of the federal law. So when you have that, we see the Supreme Court will oftentimes accept those petitions for certiorari in order to make the application of the federal law uniform.
Now you're thinking, when you file this petition for certiorari, that maybe the Supreme Court will agree to take your case. And let's point out, the Supreme Court only took, what, 75 cases last year?
Took 75 cases out of 9,000 petitions.
Right. So let's talk a little bit about that. You mentioned that that strange term, certiorari, and a petition for it. That itself, just preparing such a petition, you have to put a lot of work into, don't you?
A significant amount of work.
Yeah.
I couldn't tell you the number of hours that we put into the petition. I can tell you that we had in excess of 300 hours from the time the petition was granted, preparing the briefs, doing the research, and
but that's
also,
post. The very first thing, and I think people don't realize this, is that petitioning the U.S. Supreme Court, if you're going to do it properly, if you're not somebody sitting in a jail somewhere writing on ruled paper, which still happens, you're going to have to go out and go through a whole process. Don't you have to get them bound?
Correct.
And certain colors of paper and all the rest of it. And the basic purpose of filing that is to convince the Supreme Court that you have a case that's important enough for them to spend some time on.
It is. It's kind of like when you begin this research, it's to convince them to take it and to point out the difference in the areas, the different theories and what one circuit has ruled and what they based that on. It's kind of like looking at this big jar of jelly bellies, the jelly beans, and they're all different colors.
Right.
And so it's this great big jar, and so what you're doing is you're going into this jar and you're getting all the colors that suit your theory that's contained in, for example, the Fifth Circuit, as well as all the cases that's in the Second Circuit, and why they came to this conclusion. And those two circuits in our theory, they came to the same conclusion using different vehicles. Mm-hmm. And so you want to use those vehicles and hopefully point out the era of the Fourth Circuit's thought process. And, of course, the stipulation of evidence on the cocaine in the Williams case traveling interstate, that was a significant factor that was different. In the Needham case, in the Peterson case, there were no stipulations. It was all a matter of proof, the evidence that was put on.
Okay. So you go through this very lengthy and difficult process of just asking the court to hear your case, and then one day you got a notification. How did you find out that your petition had been granted?
A friend of mine called me.
Uh-huh. Really?
Yeah, from the Federal Defender's Office in Roanoke, and I was kind of left speechless and sort of got a little weak-kneed.
That's the moment at which you realize that within a few months you're going to be standing in front of the Supreme Court. That was a little scary, wasn't it?
It wasn't as scary. I mean, I look forward to that opportunity, but just the fact that you were one of the thousands. I mean, one of the few that was selected out of the thousands. I mean, it was just it was overwhelming. I mean, it's a very emotional moment.
And then after that moment passed, then you suddenly realized, I have got my
A
boatload of work.
I got to go to work now.
I'm going to guess that that you weren't making a huge amount of money off this case either. This was appointed counsel at work, wasn't it?
The Supreme Court doesn't appoint counsel. And I had two choices. I could continue this case on, or I could give it to one of the people that's in what they call the Supreme Court Bar. Now, by Supreme Court Bar, there is no official bar of that nature, but you have a group of attorneys nationwide who solicit these cases because that's what they want to do. They want to argue these cases.
So they were calling you up trying to get you to give this case up.
We had calls from firms in New York, Washington, San Francisco, Atlanta. But my answer was no to all of them.
Sure. Well, I've actually talked to another lawyer, a lawyer from Tennessee, about this very issue. He took a very significant case to the Supreme Court about 20 years ago. And that was the first time I realized that, you know, these cases pop up all over the nation. Mm-hmm. They don't all pop up, you know, two blocks from the Supreme Court. They pop up in Tennessee. They pop up in Virginia. And suddenly the lawyer who is in many cases taking it right from the very beginning starts getting all these calls from these high-powered lawyers. And they're all just basically trying to take his case away from him. And did any of them sort of pressure you saying you're going to screw this up and you better give it to us because you're not capable of doing this and we are?
Well, for the most part, but they were all very professional and cordial about it. But we did have one group in Washington. They made a number of calls and pretty much close to, I think, I don't remember it specifically, but I would imagine it was the last call. And in a very polite way, they said, "You don't know what you're doing. I want this case."
Man.
And at that point in time, I went back over my history of practice and the number of appellate cases that I'd done and assured them that I felt fairly confident in my abilities. So.
Well, good for you. Good for you. You didn't let the fancy pants lawyers from Washington or wherever come in and take your case away from you. I mean, you know, to a great extent, I side with people like you. The other lawyer I spoke to, he's from Cleveland, Tennessee. I sided with him as well. I mean, you're from the region. You know the case. You've lived with the case for years. And except in extreme circumstances, you know, a lawyer like that is going to be quite capable of arguing because the Supreme Court, with all of its fancy finery, you're going to tell me in a minute about that, but I'm guessing it's pretty much the same process, isn't it?
It is, and we'll get to that here.
Okay. First, let's talk about all the work you did, all the briefs.
Well, as you said, the petition for cert is a creature in and of itself, and it does involve a great deal of research, which it's something that I enjoy doing. There's nothing like the battle in a courtroom. I'm really in my environment when I'm trying a jury trial. It's just a phenomenal process. It builds your energy, and you know the adrenaline's flowing, and it just doesn't stop till it's over. So whether it's a 3-week trial or a 3-hour trial, they're exciting. But there comes a moment when, for me personally, it's gratifying to sit down and just focus on an academic, purely academic question, which takes me back to my law school days, which was a number of years ago. But that's a different environment and it's a different process. Mm-hmm. And so as you're doing this research, you're looking for thought patterns. You're looking for explanations of legal principles and how facts plug into them. And one of the things, you know, we talked about or mentioned, you know, is the Constitution. It's the greatest instrument and document that we have in this country. Now, that one document, I think, sets us apart from every government on the planet.
I'm not going to argue with you on that.
And when you look, just taking into consideration the Bill of Rights, first 10 amendments, what most people, I don't think, realize, I mean, and they're phenomenal amendments, you know, freedom of speech and that sort of thing. But when you look at them and take them in toto, it's four of those amendments affects a person's right when he or she is accused of crime. We devoted more time to protecting a person's rights in being accused of a crime than any other aspect of our lives.
Mm-hmm. I mean, that's pretty important because that's a vehicle through which a government can oppress people.
Right.
I mean, what do you do if you're a bad guy and you want to silence your critics? You just accuse them of being criminals and you drag them through a rigged court system. So that makes sense.
So when you start off with that basic premise and you're getting back to the pure academic study of a case and a factual situation and an accusation, that's where I start from. And that's really what drives me. Okay, has this person's rights been properly protected here? in all phases of this trial. And so you're looking for these words and these phrases in the statutes that are at the underlying charging element, and the interpretation of those words and phrases through the application of the law and the interpretation that the Supreme Court has put on those words and phrases.
And again, putting together not just the petitions, but now the briefs,
well, the briefs
in the Supreme Court case, right, is also very, very time-consuming, very expensive. Each brief, the appellant's brief, the appellee's brief, the reply brief, or petitioner and respondent, perhaps, each has to, again, be bound. It has to be in a special right color, and all the rest of it. There are very, very specific rules. And, of course, back of all of that is this, all this research you've done and all the thinking you've done and all the careful drafting. Now, this is all happening last year in the fall of 2015, right?
Right, and you're put on a schedule.
Right.
I mean, you have a deadline to have all this work prepared. It's a reasonable deadline, but you really aren't going to do anything other than work on that project during that deadline.
It's Weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and I'm speaking with Abingdon, Virginia attorney Dennis Jones, all about what it's like to take a constitutional case all the way from whatever little town you happen to live in to the United States Supreme Court. After the break, we'll have our Madison Minute, and then we'll finish our discussion with Dennis Jones. Stick around.
He is quite a short, thin man, with his head bald except on the back, where his hair hangs down to his collar and over his ears, nicely powdered. He has gray but bright eyes and small features. He looks scarcely as old as he is, and seems very hale and hearty. The expression on his face is full of good humor. He was dressed in black, with breeches and old-fashioned top boots which he afterwards took off, and sat the evening in his white stockings. But the next day he had black silk on and looked very nice. I talked with, or rather listened to, Mr. Madison almost exclusively while I remained. We sat up pretty late. His favorite topic appeared to be the early constitutional history of this country, the state of the Confederacy originally, the points involved in the Constitution, the errors relative to many facts which he pointed out, etc. The next morning I was down sometime before the ladies, but found him already reading in the parlor. With your Madison Minute, I'm Jen Patia Howell.
You're listening to your Weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and we're speaking with Dennis Jones, who's an attorney in Abingdon, Virginia, not far from where I teach. And Dennis is telling us not so much about the substance of the case that he recently argued in front of the United States Supreme Court, which involved the Commerce Clause and a criminal statute and all those sorts of things, but we're focusing really to a greater extent on the process of getting there. And it turns out this process lasts just months and months, and during that time, you pretty much work on nothing else. Now, it was during that, and it was while you were working and thinking and writing these briefs, that you came up to speak to a class where I teach, at the Appalachian School of Law, which is a couple hours north of Abingdon. And then what were you there for? What happened there?
Well, Judge Larry Kirksey, who's a longtime friend of mine, we
great guy, by the way. Hi, Larry.
I hope he's listening.
He better be.
Larry, we go back many years. Both of us graduated from the University of Tennessee Law School.
I teach in the summer. Another great place.
Yeah.
All right.
Larry's a bit younger than I am, so
he looks a lot older. He's kind of decrepit.
Well, that's because he was a judge.
That must be it. You know,
it has significant wear and tear.
That's right.
Particularly on him,
mm-hmm.
And Larry and I, in the early '80s, we served on the then what was called the Ninth District Virginia State Bar Ethics Committee, which of course policed misconduct of attorneys, and of course he became Commonwealth Attorney in the city of Bristol. I think his term began after mine did in Russell County. So we encountered, I mean, we were just good friends, and but anyway, he was doing some substitute teaching over there. I think he taught a semester, and he was teaching criminal procedure. And so he invited three guests. He invited myself, and then he invited Assistant United States Attorney Zach Lee, and then, of course, former retired Supreme Court Justice Cynthia Kinder as guest speakers that term. I was first. I don't know why they put the defense on first. The prosecution should have gone first, but anyway. We talked about the Fourth Amendment, and I met a number of students over there at that time. That was in that was actually in late September, before the writ had been granted.
Well,
met a young lady by the name of Megan Barger,
very nice young lady.
Nice young lady.
Yeah.
Sharp, really sharp. Brett Hall and Aaron Gillespie. Aaron's from up around Bluefield, West Virginia.
Now, Brett Hall's kind of a loser, but
Brett,
he's nice. He sits in the back row and makes fun of me. Aaron Gillespie's actually an alum of the university where we're talking right now, where I should mention we're in the studios of WEHC at Emory and Henry College. And Aaron and I go back years because when he was an undergraduate, I taught a First Amendment seminar here, and he was in that. So I know these students pretty well, and they were apparently quite taken with your presentation.
Well, I hope so. We tried to give them a little helpful insight into the Fourth Amendment and search and seizure. But anyway, our writ was granted on October the 1st. And shortly thereafter, I had a conversation with Larry. And I think maybe while I spoke that it may have come up that we had this petition filed. But Larry became aware of it, and he made that announcement to the students. And Megan reached out to me and offered her assistance along with Aaron and Brett. And
I wish I could take some credit for that, but I can't. This is to their great credit. They basically took the initiative and said, we're willing to come work for you for free because this is such
That's
a cool thing.
I did.
And, of course, being a smart lawyer, you said, absolutely, I'll take some free labor.
The this case, when you get back to the Fourth Circuit argument, I think you have to give back, you know, what you've gotten. So we have always had clerks in our office. Senator Ben Chafin was one of my clerks.
State senator.
State senator. Mike Moore, who's circuit court judge over in Russell County, he started. We started him out in our office as a first-year law student. So we've had a number of successful law students come through our office as clerks over the years, and really proud of that. And
what sort of stuff did you have them do? Getting your coffee, making copies?
Well, no, that don't teach you anything.
Good.
I get my own coffee. Our purpose, what we like to do is we like to clerk a student for two sessions. After their first year, they can come in they'd kind of carry a suitcase, briefcase, if you will. So they just tag along, and they learn where the courts are and the various places we go, where to stand. People don't realize that, you know, we have this thing called the bar, and that's really it's a bar that's between where the visitors sit and where the courtroom work goes on. So if you're not a member, a licensed attorney, unless you get permission and consent, you can't come past the bar. So we always get that for our clerks, and so they get to do that. And we have them doing research on issues. We have them writing memorandums. And
is that the sort of stuff that that you had them doing then?
Well, that's what we got them doing, and they I took the core argument, and I gave it to them for their review and then for them to add to. And so they came up with some good ideas. They came up with ideas, frankly, that I hadn't considered.
Oh, that's great.
That's
really pleasant because these are all second-year law students, and they were in my constitutional law class at the time. And, in fact, we had just studied the Commerce Clause, or we were studying it roughly the time that cert was granted for you. And so they came to me several times and said, man, this is stuff we had right in class. And we're doing this and we're doing that. It was a very good experience for them.
So sometimes, you know, when you want to be like a sponge. You want all these ideas and you want to generate as many ideas. And obviously, when you got a narrow issue, you discard a lot of them, but you need to consider them anyway.
Sure.
And so sometimes you don't. If you've got someone who's got a fresh look at it, particularly a student, because the students are they're in pure academia world, and they can give you some input and insights to where when you get old like I am and kind of more narrow minded and set in your ways, you exclude sometimes when you should not. And so that's what they do. It's a freshness.
Well, I agree with you completely, Dennis. In fact, that's one of the things I enjoy most about teaching, is that you really do. I mean, these are, as my dad used to say, he worked at a university. He said he never looked any older in the mirror each morning, but every year the students looked younger. Yeah. And that's certainly my perception as well. And all these students I'm thinking of now, I can see their faces. They all look very young, but they're smart and they're curious and they're eager. And frequently in class, somebody will say something and I'll think to myself, I've been teaching this for 10 years and it's never occurred to me to think of it that way. So yes, I can see that value. Great. Well, then I'm very glad that you had this great experience with Aaron and Brett and with Megan. But now let's get back to it, because we're going to run out of time if we don't. They helped you put the briefs in.
Right.
And then you had to get ready for oral argument. Did they help you getting ready for the oral argument as well?
We had some inclement weather, and we just didn't have time to do that. But we did exchange some ideas and some thoughts by emails. And, of course, our argument was scheduled for February the 23rd, and they had some breaks and but the contribution that they made to the case was consistent throughout and hopefully was rewarding to them.
Oh, I know it was because then you took them with you February.
They went with us. Sure did.
They sure did. Wow. They were excited about that. Yeah. In fact, they came to me and told me how excited they were about that. And then I started seeing pictures being posted on Facebook. The only disappointment they had, they said, was that Justice Scalia had just passed away just before you got there. So you argued to an 8-member court, and there was still crepe up on the bench.
Right.
And that's sad in and of itself, but I think Aaron in particular had always admired Justice Scalia, and so I think that was too bad for him, especially that he get to meet him.
Well, the loss of Justice Scalia has had a dramatic effect on that court. I mean, but any time that happens on that court, the loss of that mind and that individual is certainly significant. But Justice Scalia was a true champion of the Constitution. He had written a case. Actually, it was a dissenting opinion in the case of United States versus Evans, which was also a Hobbs Act case. And it was he wrote about the elements of the Hobbs Act.
Right.
And Justice Thomas, Justice Scalia, Chief Justice Rehnquist. There was another one. I've forgotten who that was. It may have been Kennedy. I've forgotten just now. But we cited that case, and actually it was I don't know which one of the three it was, but I think they brought the Evans case to my attention, and they were looking at everything. I was doing the research, I was kind of looking at the majority opinions.
But my students found you a dissent.
They found me a dissent.
And that's very, very important. Dissents are written for a number of reasons, but one of them is essentially to stake out a position for the future. And if you know that one of the justices to whom you're going to be arguing has taken this position in a dissent before, then you're going to get ready for him to be on your side, and you're going to tailor your argument for him. That must have been such a blow to you.
Right, it was.
When Justice Scalia passed away, you're thinking, oh, man, I was ready for him, and I was ready for his questions, and I was ready for an assist, and then he wasn't there. Is that going to – well, I don't want to get to the outcome of the case yet, but that's something that could potentially lead to a tie or to change the outcome of the case.
Yeah, it is.
Okay. Well, now tell us what it was like actually being in the court.
Well, as you go into the court, what most people don't realize is you look at this at the court. It's a magnificent structure, and you have these steps leading up to the front door. That's not where you go in. In order to gain entrance, you go around to the left But if you're an arguing attorney, a presenter, you go around to the right side in the basement level. You're greeted by one of the marshals of the United States Supreme Court. And then they, in turn, they give you your credentials for the presentation for you and your guests. You're then delivered to one of the deputy clerks, and the deputy clerks takes you upstairs on the courtroom floor. There, the attorneys are taken to the attorney's lounge, and your guests are, you're segregated at that point in time. They go to another area. They have their seating. It's reserved seating. And then the clerk of the court, not the deputy clerk, but the clerk of the court comes in, does about a 20 to 30 minute orientation with you on where to go, where to stand, how the proceedings are going to progress, gives you a brief history and overview of the Supreme Court. It gives you, it's sort of like a pep talk, because they're explaining to you just how significant a person or a lawyer that you are, the company that you're keeping, that term of court, the number of petitions that are filed, the number that are granted.
I didn't know you got a pep talk.
Oh,
well, that's great.
Yeah,
if it doesn't scare you to death.
Well, you're sitting there and you're just in the moment, mm-hmm. and in awe. And then they take you in and set you up in the room. The Supreme Court itself is a very small chamber. The justices, of course, are sitting up higher than you are, about on a platform that's about 3 foot off the ground. And then, of course, there's the bench and bar in front of them, mm-hmm. with their working table. You're sitting, your desk is touching that. I mean, it's part of that furniture, mm-hmm. configuration. The lectern splits you and the Solicitor General. And then the second case is going to be argued. Those attorneys come in and set up the same time you do. Then the guests come in. They're all seated. The court starts at 10 o'clock. And one of the first, this kind of a general announcement, and they tell you that the quills, the writing quills that are there at counsel table is yours to take.
And yours is framed on your office wall.
And pretty much. And so then you get up. Each argument is 30 minutes.
Right.
And so when you get up, you reserve a little bit of time for—
Because you were the petitioner.
Right.
So you get a little bit of rebuttal.
I reserve four minutes for my rebuttal.
Right.
And so when the clerk called the case, Chief Justice Roberts addressed him, and I wrote my argument down for the court. I had it on a pad, full pad, clean pad, and my handwritten argument consisted of three sentences. And I got, after I said, Chief Justice Roberts, may it please the court, I got those three sentences out in a span of 48 seconds, and Justice Ginsburg asked me the first question. And 26 minutes later, without being even remotely aware of the passage of the time, my white light went off. Quickest 26 minutes of my life.
So it was very active from the court. The court was questioning actively. Well, good.
You're close enough to Chief Justice Roberts to where if he leans forward, halfway forward, and you lean forward halfway, you can reach out and touch hands. That's, mm-hmm. that's really how it's closest judge I've ever been to.
Right. So did you high five him at the end of the argument?
Yeah, you could. Yeah. But you go into these circuit uh-huh. courtrooms, these state courtrooms, and the judge is like a stone throw. You'd have to get a slingshot to
but
fire.
You're right there.
So you're right there, and that was it was just such a close. Closely assimilated configuration of everyone that was involved, and they're very pointed. These people, I mean, obviously they're extremely brilliant, and having done that so many times and questioned people, but the respect that they give their attorneys, and I was at home. I mean,
you've done this before. It was basically the same as another oral argument, except maybe the level of questioning a little higher, perhaps.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And a lot of hypotheticals.
Right. And that's because they're always concerned.
They're always concerned.
They know that they're going to make a decision that's going to be followed with implications all over the country. Well, how do you think it went?
Justice Thomas was on the dissent in the United States versus Evans case. So I kind of think that Justice Thomas and Justice Sotomayor and Justice Kennedy seemed to be more receptive
to your argument.
To our argument.
Okay, but that's only 3 out of 8. Do you think you had a fourth or a fifth?
And Justice Roberts was friendly.
Uh-huh.
But in processing it, I don't know if he was the arbitrator, because the justices, they argue amongst themselves. You know, they'll ask you a question, and then they'll say, well, he said this, and, well, no, but he meant this. And so it's a real pleasant experience being in front of them, because not only will they ask you things, but when they come up with an idea and one of them is, kind of contradicts that or is in it, well, no, you need to think this way and you need to look at this particular issue. Justice Kagan, the reason that I wanted to mention the word effects is Justice Kagan, during her questioning or at the conclusion of it, she made comments. She said, well, Mr. Jones, the word effects just doesn't do much work in this statute for me. And I kind of thought that might come up from somebody.
Mm-hmm.
And so my response to her was, well, Justice Kagan, there are 17 federal criminal statutes that use the phrase commerce. And of those 17, 16 of them use the word in commerce, but only one uses the word effects.
Oh, commerce. That was a good argument.
So my suggestion or my response to you is this. If Congress hadn't meant for it to have an effect on commerce, they would not have used the word effect, but would have used the word in.
Uh-huh.
So that's the only way I can explain it.
Very good.
So she didn't say anything more to me, so I don't
know. Maybe you satisfied her. What's your crystal ball tell you? Are you expecting good news?
I don't think you can predict it. I just really don't.
When do you think they're going to make a decision? June?
Well, there were three cases this term of court involving the Hobbs Act. One of them was Ocasio versus United States. That was argued on October the 6th. That was an overt act of commerce extortion affecting commerce. Mm-hmm. Came out of Baltimore. Two police officers were involved. You had the case of McDonnell versus United States, which was just argued yesterday.
Our governor, yeah.
Mm-hmm. And that was the overt act of extortion affecting commerce and Hobbs Act. And then you had my case, which was the overt act of robbery.
This sounds like the year of the Hobbs Act in the Supreme Court. I think you lucked out in that regard. They were obviously wanting to look at the Hobbs Act.
Yeah.
But if they're looking at it, maybe they're looking to limit it. Maybe they're thinking federal prosecutors have gotten a little too aggressive.
Well, the pendulum always swings almost to the bending point before it rights itself. But at the end of the day, when the Supreme Court gets these cases, based on my research, they have a way of trying to get it back towards center where it should be.
Well, maybe that'll work in your favor.
Maybe it will. We'll see.
Well, I'll tell you, will you let us know when the...
Sure will.
Absolutely. We'll be watching the paper for it. Maybe we'll have to have a follow-up interview.
Well, that'd be fine.
Well, Dennis Jones of Abingdon, Virginia, and we really thank you very much for sharing with us your experience in front of the United States Supreme Court.
Thank you. It's been my pleasure.
This is Wayne Winkler, the executive producer of your weekly Constitutional, and we have a postscript for this story. We thought you'd like to know that just a few days ago, the United States Supreme Court decided against Mr. Jones' client, Anthony Taylor. The court held that Mr. Taylor's prosecution did not violate the Commerce Clause of the Constitution.
And that's our show. Thanks so very much to Dennis Jones, and thanks also to my students, Aaron Gillespie, Megan Barger, and Brett Hall, who brought us all together. Our executive producer is Wayne Winkler. Our scheduler is Carol Hutchinson. Our Madison Minute is by Jen Patia Howell of the Robert H. Smith Center for the Constitution at James Madison's historic home, Montpelier. Our distribution engineer is Chad Barrett. Our music is by the Fifes and Drums of Colonial Williamsburg. My name is Stuart Harrison. Remember, you are a part of the American experiment.